This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. Well, studies have shown that exposure to tobacco smoke in utero, meaning while in the womb, can cause a fetus to suffer lung damage and may be at a higher risk of developing lung cancer and heart disease as adults. They also have a higher chance of dying from sudden infant death syndrome and are at a greater risk of developing behavioral problems such as attention deficit hyperactivity disorder or ADHD. Well, now there's even more to the story. And here with more on this is Dr. Stephen Jungentaub. He's a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Jungentaub. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for inviting me.
So fetal nicotine exposure has a lot of consequences. Tell us about that.
Well, so as you pointed out, there are all kinds of developmental problems that happen with children that are exposed via maternal smoking. And, of course, the most severe of which is that these kids can be stillborn, they're low birth weight, another number of developmental defects depending upon how extensive the mother's smoking is.
And a high percentage of women, or at least I read somewhere, like 25% of pregnant women continue to smoke through their pregnancies?
Yeah, it's sort of odd that given all the warnings and the health risks that are associated, that 25 to 30% of women who were smokers prior to becoming pregnant continue to smoke.
Wow. But you also found something else, or at least there were some human studies that demonstrated a fourfold increased possibility that if you smoked during your pregnancy, that your child later would become a smoker?
So that's correct. It's sort of interesting that these children whose mom smoked during pregnancy have a fourfold higher risk to initiate smoking behavior. They do so at an earlier age, and then they go on to potentially have a higher risk of long-time life tobacco addictions.
Yep. So the point is, this was already established, but then you decided to do some background or some analysis of why this happens. Is that correct?
Correct.
But there's some background to that. Your lab has been involved in looking at the underpinnings of some other addiction. Tell us about that first.
So we've actually have a long history in our lab, and also as part of a larger SUNY collaborative called the Developmental Alcohol Research Center, which is a collaborative between Upstate investigators and those at Binghamton University. And so we're interested in this relationship between fetal exposure and adolescent exposure and then lifetime use of alcohol. And you see the same phenomena with alcohol. It's the number one predictor. That is, prior fetal exposure is the number one predictor of abuse.
To clarify, if a mom continues drinking through pregnancy, the chances are very great that their infant will become addicted to alcohol?
Correct.
Wow.
Actually, they have a higher probability of initiating the behavior. They do so earlier, and they become adult abusers.
So you've done a lot of work in that area. Is that what led you to look at this nicotine exposure?
So that's correct. So the nicotine work is a spinoff. And the basis for doing both of them is this normally adaptive mechanism that works to the advantage of an animal in even humans. And it's, oddly enough, one of the ways that you learn what's good to eat is by virtue of what mom eats and drinks during pregnancy. And it's sort of interesting when I do seminars and talks about this for lay people, uniformly will say, oh yeah, you know, I have cravings for this because my mom ate this during pregnancy.
Wow. So you're saying it's pretty common knowledge that this exists.
At least people will certainly report that, yes.
But you think it makes sense. It's almost the way the species survives. If even in utero you're learning kind of what's good food, so to speak.
Oh, that's exactly right. And so we began thinking about alcohol and nicotine not as drugs of abuse per se, but just as a normal chemical stimulus, something that you would ingest. And there's lots and lots of data for this kind of fetal learning or fetal plasticity in the literature. So we wanted to see if this potentially was at least one of the factors underlying this enhancement of preference for alcohol or nicotine. And indeed, it does.
So tell us what you did. What was your study about? Or how did you undertake this?
So we're using a rat model. Oddly enough, it's not a surprise that we can't actually, you know, do these kinds of studies in humans, because you can't sort of morally give alcohol to pregnant mothers to actually study the progeny, although you can do this with some innocuous odors and stimuli. So here we basically use a rat model because their developmental periods and their behaviors can be very similar to humans, and they express many of the same sorts of intake patterns. So we've been using a rat model for decades to study these sorts of things. And for the nicotine, basically, we give the pregnant mothers a daily dose. Actually, we put this little osmotic pump under their skin. It's just a way to deliver nicotine continuously over time. And for our experiments for the nicotine, we were giving them doses that would sort of give you about 1 to 2 pack a day smoker. So not super heavy smokers, but just sort of a moderate smoker.
And so you delivered it to them.
So the moms get it.
Through the natural process of, I don't know, is it osmosis or whatever it is, that the babies then are exposed because they're in utero, so to speak, and they are getting bathed somehow in that substance. Is that correct?
Correct. So there are three ways that the fetus is exposed. It gets into the maternal blood. By virtue of getting to the maternal blood, it also gets into the amniotic fluid, right? The liquid that bathes the baby during pregnancy. The chemicals in the amniotic fluid also cross the skin, so there's exposure that way. But most people don't realize that developing babies, humans and other animals, they actually ingest amniotic fluid. So they're eating this stuff or drinking whatever's in the amniotic fluid, just like, you know, you would if I picked up this glass of water that I have here. Mm. And so there are several routes of exposure.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, and I'm here with Dr. Stephen Jungentaub, and he's a professor of psychiatry at Upstate Medical University. And we're talking about his research study that proved how fetal exposure to alcohol smoke can predispose, in this case it was rat babies, but it's the underpinning for how babies being exposed to this, human babies, can become smokers later in life. So tell us a little bit more. What exactly did you find then?
So when we talk about, in the beginning, how moms will eat foods and they have preferences, and then that's a way that the child learns to, you know, to sort of prefer those sorts of things, you have to sort of think about what is it that you focus on when you talk about liking a particular food substance, right? And that's really flavor perception, right? The taste, the smell, the mouthfeel of a food source or a drink. So it turns out that this fetal exposure alters your perception, your flavor perception of these amniotic contaminants, in this case nicotine, in other studies alcohol. And so what we did is for this first series of studies for the nicotine exposures was looked at the odor component. You know, would you be more attracted? You know, most people find cigarette smoke pretty aversive, especially non-smokers. So the question was, do animals that have had prior fetal nicotine exposure have this innate, this inborn attraction to the odor of nicotine? Turns out that that's in fact the case. So the aversive properties of nicotine odor, and if you actually smell nicotine, it smells just like cigarette smoke, they're more attracted to it.
Wow.
So this sort of primes the animal to be attracted to something that we know is not good for them.
That they may not have otherwise had any interest in.
Correct.
So basically what it's doing is it's shaping their orientation towards something. Just as you said, if it were a foodstuff or something of that nature, it would make them be preferentially attracted to it.
Yeah, I think that's a very good way to describe it.
That's pretty significant right there.
Yeah. And then what we also found was if you look at the olfactory system, sort of the system, the cells in your nose that respond to these odors, that the system itself, when we look at it neurophysiologically, electrically, that the response becomes tuned, right? So you can actually see a difference in the way a rat baby who's been exposed to nicotine during development in the womb, they respond differently to the odor of nicotine than do normal unexposed animals.
So what basically then from all of this, I mean, obviously what you've done is you've documented on a physiological level what has been observed or shown perhaps on a clinical level before. with humans. So what's the takeaway from all that?
Well, for us, it's a very big takeaway. What we have been showing is that there are these developmental mechanisms by which mother patterns of drug use, in this case, alcohol or nicotine, actually can be transferred to their offspring. So that's pretty, I think, for us, very significant. It's a generalized phenomena, and once you give some pause for that these exposures have many subtle effects beyond the sort of the really, really extreme effects.
Does it explain in some ways why, for example, alcoholism may run in families? I mean, is there some, especially if it's a mother-to-infant connection? I mean, in other words, if the mother is an alcoholic or drinks excessively, is there some explanation then for that pattern that we see?
Well, only in part. Right, so you have to sort of, I'm going to get a little technical, but you have to separate sort of genetic mechanisms mm-hmm. from epigenetic mechanisms. Mm-hmm.
And this is considered epigenetic
mechanisms. So what happens is, because of these epigenetic mechanisms, and at least we know this quite extensively for the alcohol work, that there are genetic changes in these systems that are important to taste and smell and oral mouthfeel to make alcohol more acceptable. And
more attractive.
That too, yes. And so the big question ultimately is you need to break the cycle, right? Because otherwise these epigenetic mechanisms preclude these children to have a higher propensity to drink, become adult abusers, and then, as we call it, the alcoholism generator, it recycles again.
So this is really very important because you've really found, as you said, the physiologic basis for things that have been observed in the past.
Well, at least, yes, a component to it. And there are likely other mechanisms involved as well.
Who did you collaborate with? Obviously, you were alluding to this before. There's a larger consortium working on this?
So for the alcohol work, yes, we have a very large SUNY research center called the Developmental Alcohol Research Center, which is a collaborative between Upstate Medical University investigators and people at Binghamton University. And then the nicotine work, which is more localized, is a collaboration between myself and Frank Middleton. And, of course, all this work was actually done by a graduate student in my lab by the name of Nicole Mantella. This is her thesis project.
Wow. Very significant. And it's being published, or it has not yet been published?
So the nicotine work's already been published.
Very exciting. How long did the whole study take to do?
Approximately 2 years.
Mm-hmm. So this is the kind of thing I think people have to understand, especially in these days with the sequester. People don't, I think, appreciate how chilling an effect lack of funding can be to some projects, because they're not something that takes place over weeks.
That's correct.
They take place over years. So I want to thank you. This is very interesting. Are there any follow-up studies planned?
So the follow-up studies for the nicotine work would be to look at what happens to these chemosensory effects when the animal gets a second exposure. So one of the things that we've shown in for the alcohol is that an adolescent exposure, that second exposure, augments the effective field exposure.
So it's additive.
So it's additive.
The whole thing is additive. Wow. Very profound, actually. My guest has been Dr. Stephen Jungenthal. He's professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Upstate Medical University, and he's been doing very interesting research on fetal exposure to both tobacco and alcohol. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
I hope
you'll
come back and tell us any new things that you find down the road in this arena. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.